Earth Sky.
Welcome to Earth Sky 22, your weekly mix of science and music from Austin, Texas. I'm Michael Brennan. This week, the Moon and Jupiter pair up in the night sky. We'll talk about what hurricane forecasters do in their off-season and what was learned from Hurricane Sandy, plus songs by Monahans and 100 Visions. Here's your scientist soundbite.
This January 21st pairing of Jupiter and the Moon is going to be the closest pairing of Jupiter and the Moon until the year 2026.
That's skywatching expert Deborah Bird. More with her in a few, but first, Emily Howard is here to run through science news of the week. Welcome, Emily.
Thanks, Mike. On January 15th, NASA released images of the site where the Curiosity rover on Mars might drill into its first Martian rock. Curiosity is currently poised on the edge of this possible drilling site. If the site meets engineers' approval, Curiosity will make its drilling debut a few days from now.
Yaks are back. A team of conservationists recently counted nearly 1,000 wild yaks from a remote area of the Tibetan Qinghai Plateau. The finding may indicate a comeback for the species, which was decimated by overhunting in the mid-20th century.
Scientists have been able to reconstruct, for the first time, the intricate three-dimensional structure of the backbone of early tetrapods, the earliest four-legged animals. High-energy X-rays and a new data extraction protocol allowed the researchers to reconstruct the backbones of the 360 million-year-old fossils in exceptional detail, and it sheds new light on how the first vertebrates moved from water onto land.
The new 2013 South Pole marker has been revealed and set in place, and the new brass and copper plaque that tops the marker gives a shout-out to Neil Armstrong, first human to walk on the moon, and to former planet Pluto. The Amundsen Scott South Pole Station sits on a moving sheet of ice more than 2 miles thick. Because the ice is moving, the site where the marker for the South Pole is installed, along with an American flag, drifts about 30 feet per year. That's why every year in early January, the site is resurveyed and the marker is moved. This yearly move keeps the marker in close proximity to the point where lines of longitude meet at Earth's actual geographic South Pole. And that's science news of the week. Thanks, Emily.
Thanks, Mike.
Song of the week is Diamonds by Austin band Monahans.
We rock.
You're listening to Earth Sky 22, 22 minutes of science and music. You can find us as Earth Sky on Facebook, Earth Sky Science on Twitter, and at earthsky.org. Deborah Bird is here to talk about the close pairing of the Moon and Jupiter. Welcome, Deborah.
Hi, Mike. Jupiter and the Moon. You may have already seen them a few months ago or last month. In fact, Jupiter and the Moon were close on Christmas night.
Yeah, that was beautiful.
It was beautiful, and many people in the U.S. saw it. But this January 21st pairing of Jupiter and the Moon is going to be the closest pairing of Jupiter and the Moon until the year 2026.
Whoa.
So they're going to be even closer, and they're going to look really, really cool.
Cool. So how do we see them? When do they come up at night?
Well, so when the sun goes down, and I'm not only talking about January 21st, which is when they'll be closest, but also, say, starting the 19th or 20th, when the sun goes down, you'll be able to find both the moon and Jupiter in the sky already. So Jupiter will be up in the east. The moon will be moving over those nights, over the 19th and 20th. The moon is moving in orbit around Earth, of course. And every night it's moving a little bit toward the east on our sky's dome. So it's going to be moving over the 19th and the 20th toward Jupiter. And if you watch on all three of those nights, the 19th, 20th, and 21st, you'll be able to see the moon get closer and closer and closer to Jupiter, finally closest on the 21st.
Cool. So it'll be moving closer, and then they'll be sort of rising together.
That's right. On the 21st, when you go outside, you won't see them rise because they'll already be up when the sun goes down. So when the sun goes down, just look in the eastern sky, and you'll see Jupiter and the moon shining there.
Okay, great. So is this a full moon? Is this a waxing or a waning moon? What are we looking at when we see this conjunction?
It's going to be a waxing gibbous moon. And what the word gibbous means that the moon is more than half lighted, but less than full. So it's not quite a full moon. So Jupiter, Earth went between the sun and Jupiter in early December. And a full moon is always opposite the sun, and Jupiter was opposite the sun in early December, too. So it was in December that we saw Jupiter near a full moon. Now, Earth has moved on, and it's faster orbit around the sun. And so we're seeing Jupiter in just a little bit different position with respect to our moon. So now we're seeing it next to this waxing gibbous moon, not quite a full moon in the east when the sun goes down.
Okay. And will they pass each other and become further apart then?
Yeah, that's right.
Okay.
So actually, it's the moon that's passing Jupiter. Jupiter's moving too, but it's moving much more slowly than the moon, you know, on our sky's dome. So you won't really see Jupiter moving. But if you watch over several nights, you'll see the moon moving with respect to Jupiter. So after the 21st, the moon will start getting farther, farther, farther from Jupiter again. And, you know, I noticed I put together just a few days ago some photographs that our friends on Facebook had posted over the past few months of Jupiter and the moon. And people were taking pictures of Jupiter and the moon, not just when they were closest, but on all kinds of days, you know, a week away from when they were closest, say, or even farther away than that. And so that's because Jupiter is the brightest thing we're going to see, the brightest star-like object we're going to see in the night sky until Venus comes up just before dawn. And Venus is very close to the dawn now, so it's not super noticeable. So Jupiter is very noticeable. It's very bright. It's in the sky for much of the night. So if you come to earthsky.org, you'll find those wonderful photos of Jupiter and the moon. Wow, they came from all over the world. And, you know, people were showing things like Jupiter and the moon above the snow and Jupiter and the moon above rivers and Jupiter and the moon with a halo around them and just all kinds of great pictures. So come to earthsky.org and look for those pictures of Jupiter and the moon.
Yeah, they're beautiful. So Jupiter's the largest planet in our solar system. So how big will it look next to the waxing gibbous moon?
Well, Jupiter is the largest planet in our solar system. And in fact, if you put the moon and Jupiter side by side, you would need 40 of Earth's moons to equal one planet Jupiter. But Jupiter's also 1,600 times farther away than the moon. So to the eye, Jupiter looks just like a star. One of the photos that I mentioned that was my favorite was someone took a photo of Jupiter and the moon through a telescope, and you could see the craters on the moon and so on, but you could also see Jupiter's moons. So you saw our moon, and then in the same picture, Jupiter and its moons, and that was a really nice picture.
Yeah, I have to check that out.
Yeah, but with the eye alone, it just looks like a star. So you'll see that very bright moon, and you'll see this bright star-like object next to it, and that will be the planet Jupiter.
Okay, great. Looking forward to it. Thanks a lot, Deborah.
Thank you.
Earthsky's Matt Daniel caught up with Dr. Rick Knapp, director of the National Hurricane Center, at the American Meteorological Society's 93rd annual meeting to talk about Hurricane Sandy and how the agency is constantly evolving their hurricane forecasting.
Back in early December, there were some reports that the National Hurricane Center was going to redefine the term of hurricane warning. And could you go into detail as to what we can expect for the 2013 season and how you're going to advance this definition?
Yeah, we reported on this here at the AMS annual meeting this week. At the end of every hurricane season, this is an annual meeting that we have internally within the Weather Service and NOAA to go through how the hurricane season this past year has gone, what changes do we want to contemplate to our operational procedures for the next year and in future years. And that begins an entire off-season process of considering the ideas that come through that conference and working toward putting those into operational implementation, pending whatever feedback we get from users and emergency management media and the public. And one of the proposals that we put through that conference is this idea that we would give ourselves two new options for the future with post-tropical cyclones. One would be that it would allow us, if adopted, to issue hurricane center advisories on a system even during its post-tropical stage, as long as it is a significant threat to life and property. The other option that this proposal would give us would be for the Weather Service to be able to leave up hurricane and or tropical storm watches and warnings for a post-tropical cyclone. Those are options we did not have during Sandy. Doesn't mean we would have utilized that during Sandy if we had them, but in any event, it did raise the issue, the dilemma, that in some cases in the future, never know exactly what Mother Nature is going to throw our way in the years to come, that we would have an option to continue advisories or not, or to put up tropical or non-tropical local warnings. So it's all about engaging our users on these ideas for the next few months, and then if everybody seems to be on board, then that might be something we have in the toolbox for 2013.
And speaking of Hurricane Sandy, I was just curious if you look back in time, the events of before it happened and after it happened, would you and your staff at the Hurricane Center, do you have any regrets or decisions that you would say today that you would have done differently, or do you think everything you did was great?
It's always easier to assess how did you do after you know how the events turn out. If you ask a forecaster, well, if you had to do over again, would you forecast that snowstorm differently? Yeah, because it snowed in Buffalo instead of Syracuse, and I forecast that it snowed in Syracuse. I'd forecast Buffalo if I had to do over again. But that's only with the benefit of knowing how everything turned out. But during the event, you have to make very difficult decisions. That's only a one-sided decision. You only know everything up to that time when you have to make the forecast. One of the big challenges with Sandy was that at the time, 2, 3, 4 days before landfall, we had to make decisions on how we were going to handle things warning-wise, how we were going to do briefings, how we were going to handle every aspect of it. We had to make those decisions without knowing exactly how it was going to turn out. And one of the big uncertainties with Sandy was not just the usual track and intensity and size uncertainties in storm surge and all that, but there was uncertainty in what kind of system it was going to be, whether it would become post-tropical well offshore a day or longer after landfall, or if it would make it to the coast almost as a hurricane. We were pretty sure all along it was going to become post-tropical some point offshore, but we didn't know how far offshore. And that's what posed the warning dilemma. So given everything that we had at the time, and knowing what we did at the time, I'm very proud of how our agency performed. But we always, always, always learn from every storm. We learn from every hurricane season. We always try to get better. And that's what we're doing this off season with some of these ideas we've already come up with.
What are some of the steps that the Hurricane Center, NOAA, is trying to do to help predict the intensity of a tropical cyclone? Because, you know, your forecast tracks are great, but the intensity is always a challenge. What are some advances in meteorology in the future that we'll be taking to be able to help predict the intensity of tropical cyclones?
Intensity forecasting has been our biggest challenge and our biggest forecast improvement need for a long time. We've seen the improvements in the track forecast over the last 2 to 3 decades, owing to the improvements in the models that are getting better and better at giving us good guidance on track forecasts. Meanwhile, the intensity forecasts haven't appreciably changed in their accuracy or lack thereof in that same time frame, because the intensity is determined not just by the external environment, but by the inner core and the environment closer to the center of the cyclone. And we know that there are three main areas that we need to address to improve intensity forecasts. One is more and better observations within the inner core and assimilation of those observations into the models, and then the computer power to run all of these models. Fortunately, there is a concerted effort that's pretty well funded and involves a lot of very talented scientists, the Hurricane Forecast Improvement Project, HFIP, where we are applying the expertise of dozens of scientists running and developing a number of different models with a dedicated supercomputer resource to test and evaluate and improve these models. We're starting to see some of this output in real time at the Hurricane Center. So a lot of resources are being applied to the problem because we know it's such a high priority.
Earth Sky's Matt Daniel, speaking with Dr. Rick Knapp, director of the National Hurricane Center. We're Earth Sky, a clear voice for science. And that's our show. Thanks for joining us. For more on the science or music, visit earthsky.org. To take you out this week, a song from 100 Visions, Make Somebody Happy. And that's good advice. I'm Michael Brennan. Earth Sky is a clear voice for science.
I'm